Happy Wednesday! You're listening to Mama Murdered a Podcast. I'm your host, AB. And this week on Mama Murdered a Podcast, we are recording live from my car in the hospital parking lot. Yeah! So, we'll see how this sounds. I'm not sure. I'm just trying to do what I can while I can. So, let's get it. This week on Mama Murdered a Podcast, we'll be covering the second part to David Parker Ray. His upbringing, his early life, and how this monster was created. But before we get started, I did want to make sure that I mentioned, because I literally always forget to mention, that even if you've already been listening to the podcast, or if this is your first time and you enjoy it, please leave me a 5-star review on Spotify. You can actually review and rate on Apple. Anywhere helps, because apparently I didn't realize how much it would help either. If you do leave a 5-star rating on Spotify, you can also hit the little notification bell and it will let you know every single time a new episode is uploaded. So let's go ahead and jump into it and figure out how one person becomes so deranged and twisted as to think that the things that we described in the tape the last episode are okay things to do to other human beings, because they are not. This is probably the most debatable case of nature versus nurture, and it all starts with a slick-back-haired hillbilly and his ugly-ass girlfriend, and I'm okay with saying that about both of them, because they are horrible, disgusting creatures, and they did this for so long, and they basically got away with it. So, let's do it. David Parker Ray was born to his parents, Cecil and Nettie Ray, on November 6, 1939, in New Mexico. Now, David's parents aren't getting any Parent of the Year awards anytime soon. Which, I mean, neither am I, but that's not why we're here. Both of his parents seem to be pretty non-existent factors in his life, but when either one of his parents would jump in and out of his life, it was always super toxic. Especially David's dad, Cecil. David's dad is probably somewhere in the dictionary under the term toxic parent, because he's just that bad. David's dad, Cecil, was extremely abusive. He was a raging drunk who took a lot of frustration out on David, his mom, and his other siblings. And that was when he decided to be around, when, you know, he decided that his family was important enough to stick around for. Because when David was just at the age of 10, his dad would finally leave the family for good, leaving David and his younger sister, Peggy, to grow up primarily living with their grandparents on their mom's side of the family. Because their mom, Nettie, was just kind of never around. Nettie did live with her parents and David and his sister Peggy at her parents' farm, but from what I could find, David and his sister Peggy were primarily raised by their grandparents, like I mentioned. So she did live in the same house with David and Peggy, she just kind of stood back and let her parents take the reins with her kids. David's grandpa was said to be a pretty strict disciplinarian, and though David's dad wasn't around for much of his life, very sporadically when he was around, his dad would bring David extremely inappropriate magazines with images of women being bound, gagged, and tortured, and they all included some kind of sadomasochistic pornography. That was hard to say. Which I always kind of wonder when I think back about this case, like, how the hell did they even get those kind of magazines back in the 50s and 60s? Like, women in their swimsuits taking pictures was considered, like, risque. So I can only imagine what their porn magazines would look like, and this is not just regular porn. Like, regular porn in the 50s and 60s was a woman who was in a bra and underwear, and that was considered raunchy porn mags. So I don't know, I wasn't alive then. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I'm just guessing. I'm so stressed. And these magazines that David got from his dad would carry a lot of weight throughout his life after he was introduced to them, especially since he was introduced to these type of things at such an early age. David started drawing pictures of girls being tied up and tortured at a pretty early age, and David's sister Peggy found some of his pictures that he drew when they were teenagers, and when she found the pictures, David just basically told his sister that they were like a new hobby that he'd picked up. Like, no big deal, these aren't red flags or anything. Like, drawing is a great hobby. But a literal child drawing images like what David was drawing is not okay. And no one thought this was weird. No one talked to David about why he felt like he needed to draw these things. And to be honest, I don't even think anyone cared enough to try to talk to him about it. So, naturally, he kept thinking it was okay and that it was normal behavior, which is exactly how that would work.
If you don't correct their behavior as a child, then the child grows up and they think that whatever behavior was never corrected is okay. Because their behavior had never been corrected and addressed by anyone before, so honestly, it doesn't surprise me that David turned out the way that he did. He was also heavily bullied at school about the way that he would communicate with girls at school, especially in high school, when you as a man are supposed to be slick and smooth and you should be able to get girlfriends, and that's just not what David was. When girls would talk to him, he would just like clam up, and that's where the bullying started at a pretty early age. And according to David himself, he started smoking, using drugs, and drinking pretty heavily around the age of like 12 or 13. So obviously there was no parental supervision in David's life, which never turns out well. And if that wasn't wild enough, at the age of 14, David decided he was finally ready to act on some of his sadistic fantasies. He was going to act them out on a real girl. And just looking at the pictures in the magazines wasn't enough for him anymore. He wanted to try to recreate the images that he was so obsessed with in real life. David himself claims to have tied a young woman up to a tree and tortured her to death when he was only 13 or 14 years old. And from what I can find, there's no way to like fact check this or debunk this claim, because by the time that he admitted to it, it had been years and years and years since it had happened, and no one was there like pressing charges and following through on this crime. So if it was David's first murder, then it's believed to be the first of around 60 or more people that David was able to kill and get away with before he was ever captured in 1999. That is, though, if he started murdering women in his teen years like he claims, which a lot of the times these guys like say things that they know damn well aren't true, but they have to overcompensate for something, and we can all just collectively gasp and agree that, you know, that's probably the case because we don't have any proof of it. And the only reason that we even know about this first murder from when David was 13 or 14 years old is because David would later tell this to his fiancée, Cindy Hendy. Now, Cindy Hendy is a woman that helped him pick up and torture women, and she helped him do a lot of this for about 8 months before they were finally caught together. David's fiancée told the police about this first alleged murder. It's believed that David kept a fairly detailed journal from the time that he was a preteen up until his arrest when he was almost 60 years old. These journals are littered with dates and names of different women and places where he's supposedly taken them to torture them, or, you know, supposed locations of their bodies. Even though the locations are believed to be written in some sort of code dating all the way back to the time he was a teenager, none of the women's names that are on the list in his journal entries have ever come forward, and it's widely believed that he probably killed a majority of his victims, and even the victims that he murdered from that far back have still never been found to this day. And it was in 1957 when David and his sister Peggy were finally split up when their grandma passed away. This is when David moved from his high school to a high school in Albuquerque, New Mexico to live with his mom, Nettie. His sister Peggy didn't move to Albuquerque with David after their grandma passed away. And even though David was picked on and bullied a lot as a kid and into his teenage years and high school years for being awkward and shy around girls, he somehow still managed to have four unsuccessful marriages after he graduated high school. So after he graduated, he got a job as a mechanic, and just like most other sick and screwed up people that we cover, David was also part of the U.S. Armed Forces and served in the U.S. Army for some time before being honorably discharged. But throughout his time in the U.S. Army, like most serial killers, murderers, whatever, he practiced perfecting his killing strategies while he was in active service. Throughout the course of his four failed marriages, David did sadly procreate, and he did have two kids. A son who they named David Jr. was born in 1960 with his first wife. And sometime after his first divorce, David was able to get full custody of David Jr. I am still not sure how that happened or where David's first wife was or what the deal was to her as to why she didn't try to fight to keep her son. But he, you know, whatever, he got full custody. So when David was called back into active duty, he left his son with his own mom, Nettie. Yep, the same mom that didn't actually raise him, so this seems like a good smart move. During one of the first times of his leave from the Army in 1962, David met and married his second wife. But this marriage was even shorter than the first one and only lasted 3 months before the two were officially divorced. They divorced almost as quickly as they married. In 1966, when David was 26, he married the mother of his second child, a daughter who they named Glenda Jean Ray, who went by the nickname Jessie Ray. David and his daughter shared a strange bond that many people can't understand or explain. David was pretty much like his own father in the way that he would sporadically pop in and out of his kid's life throughout their childhood, and he would take off and just kind of roam different areas for a while and then show back up like he never missed a beat. And it was in 1969 that David was bebopping around and hitchhiking to different towns and areas when he met another woman. And when David met his most recent girlfriend at a truck stop, David was offered a job as a mechanic and a place to live by the truck stop owners. Which was good because he was homeless at the time and he just kind of couch surfed and slept wherever he could. This girlfriend seemingly vanished one day out of nowhere, and when people asked him where she went, he just kind of made it seem like she was a gypsy soul and just not meant to stay in one place for long. So, what really happened? We probably never know. David worked a number of odd jobs and occasionally went back home to his wife and kids to play the family man role, but as much as he wanted people to think he was a normal average Joe, father and husband, he was still fantasizing about torturing women, and it eventually got to the point where David couldn't even get off without imagining that he was murdering a woman. So, that's rough. Eventually, David got a piece of land and he put a double-wide trailer on it, and this property was on Bass Road in Elephant Butte, New Mexico. And David's property backed up to Elephant Butte Lake, which is a massive body of water, and it would be the perfect dumping grounds for a sadistic murderer. Now, I know that I mentioned that David and his daughter Jessie had an unusual kind of bond, and when I say unusual, I mean it was just flat out weird as shit. Jessie knew all about David's sadistic sexual hobbies, and since she had grown up around him, she saw nothing wrong with watching her dad hire a sex worker and violently beat and torture the woman. So this was like pretty normal for Jessie. But after a fight between Jessie and her dad, David, in June of 1986, Jessie went to the New York branch of the FBI and she told them all kinds of like wild and like almost unbelievable stories about things that her dad had done before. She told the agents that her dad had kidnapped, tortured, beaten, and sold females into sex work and into human trafficking across the Mexico borders. Now, the FBI did look into these claims about David, and they did surveil him for like right at a year. They even went so far as to question him about the claims on more than one occasion, but every time they talked to David, he was always so willing to talk and answer questions, and he didn't even try to hide some of his sexual kinks. But David only shared like the normal type of stuff, like bondage and BDSM. He left out the whole holding the people against their will, raping, torturing them. He left that part out. There really wasn't much they could do because as far as they knew, he was participating in bondage and BDSM with consenting adults, which is fine. That's far from a crime. Although it said that David did tell the agents that he was potentially dangerous, and he told them that he had some kind of sexual addiction where he could live a perfectly healthy, normal life, and then out of nowhere he would get these wild sexual urges that were uncontrollable, and as messed up as that sounds, that is also not a crime, or at least he hadn't admitted to a crime at this point in the investigation, and the investigation was eventually dropped. Which is insane to me, but I'm not sure what else they could have done exactly except for watch him like a hawk until they caught him in the act of a crime. But we don't have endless amounts of money to spend watching people, so I'm not sure what else they could have done. David also had a boss that went missing out of nowhere, and it wasn't until a year later that he was found weighed down with big rocks in a big body of water, and it was determined that the man had been shot in the head execution style. And, I mean, this had to be David too. I mean, there's just so many people around him that just, like, vanish into thin air, never to be seen or heard from again. That's not suspicious. David eventually started building his quote-unquote toy box, which was essentially just a big enclosed trailer, almost like an equipment trailer that, you know, like, you usually see pulled behind, like, trucks or SUVs. The toy box eventually held more than $100,000 worth of equipment and torture device that David had built himself. Likely because they don't sell things that are that screwed up at normal adult sex stores. David was extremely handy as far as building things and fixing things goes, and even creating things, like he was good at it. He probably could have used some of his talents and created some pretty awesome shit had he not been doing, well, this. So it's no surprise that he was known around town as a master mechanic who could fix anything. David also met a woman who was somehow just as sick and twisted and messed up as himself, and that was Cindy Hendy, who I mentioned before. She and David were both into, like, very dark, malicious sex kinks. The two would mostly prey on victims in towns nearby where David lived in Elephant Butte, in a town called Truth or Consequences. So between the towns of Elephant Butte and Truth or Consequences, that's where a lot, like a majority of their victims were. And once David started working for the Elephant Butte National Parks Department, you know, this would give him access to a uniform that resembled a police uniform and access to hours and hours and hours of not being under the thumb of any management or supervision for his job. This would have also given David access to the Elephant Butte National Park, and he would basically learn the national park in a way that wasn't normal. Like, he knew every trail, every hidden spot, the perfect place to hide a body, if you will, or multiple bodies, in places that nobody else would even think to look. Now, I mentioned David's fiancée, Cindy Hendy, who helped David carry out a lot of these crimes, but his own daughter, Jessie Ray, was also a big participant in his crimes, and Jessie would even later go on to kidnap and bring women to her dad's toy box for him. So remember Jessie's name, because she's just as sick and twisted as her dad. And although it seemed to everyone else that David was living a perfectly quote-unquote normal life, he had a job, a fiance, a daughter that he had a really good relationship with, a house, all of the like normal quote-unquote normal life things, people would have no way of knowing that David was also living like his torturing, murderous fantasies out on women that he was raping and kidnapping right there in his own backyard. David met his fiancée at a local bar where a lot of the National Park employees and locals would hang out in the evenings, and she and David clicked almost instantly. They both shared the same sadistic sex kinks, and they both thought nothing of kidnapping, torturing, and raping women. Like, I would imagine that they would talk about this shit like at the dinner table with one another, kind of like, oh, how's the chicken and rice, babe? Oh, it's good, thanks, love. Want to kidnap a woman after we eat, torture her for a few days in our toy box, and then maybe let her go? Hell yeah, I do, babe. Let's do it. Like, I feel like that's how their Sunday dinners went, and it's crazy. And there are people who will try to defend Cindy Hendy and say, like, oh, she was just as much a victim as the other women he kidnapped, raped, and tortured, and that is absolutely not the case. You will never convince me that she wasn't an active and willing participant that also enjoyed the shit that they did together. You can't change my mind. David and Cindy fell in love at a bar in 1997, and it was a real trailer park love story, y'all. She helped David go through all of these, like, torturous things for almost 3 years until he was caught in 1999. Even though David had been actively kidnapping, raping, and torturing women for what most people believe was more than 40 years, so he didn't just start this when he met Cindy. Cindy was also what we would call a piece of shit. She had a few kids that she just abandoned, and she had been charged with a few crimes before she was caught helping David in their toy box shenanigans. So now you've got to be wondering how this couple did finally get caught. So let's get into that. Because it would be one woman, one very, very badass woman, who took down this entire operation that had been happening right under everyone's noses for decades. Her name was Cynthia Vigil. Cynthia is a kind of superhero that doesn't need a cape because she's just that badass. So let's get into Cynthia and all of her badassery. Cynthia was a sex worker in 1999, and she started working as a sex worker as a quick way to make money because she was trying to escape an unhealthy relationship with an ex-boyfriend. She had been staying in a hotel and she needed a way to make money, and she had to make it quick. So one night she was approached by a man and propositioned for sex. That was her literal job, so she agreed. But when Cynthia walked over to David's truck, where it was parked, this wasn't just a regular pickup truck. The truck had a small brown and white camper, or like RV-style shell, on the back of the truck bed. And when Cynthia collected the money from David for their agreed-upon price for the sex act, she bent down to put the money in her shoe, and while she was bent over, David told her that she was under arrest for soliciting sex from an undercover police officer. But before Cynthia even knew what was going on, she had handcuffs on her wrist. Cynthia immediately realized that this guy wasn't actually a cop and that the badge all of a sudden didn't look like any police badge that she had ever seen. And when Cynthia turned to open the door of the camper to try to leave, David yelled for Cindy, which was weird because Cynthia had told David that her name was Crystal. She hadn't given her real name because she did go by Cindy sometimes. It was short for Cynthia. So this kind of stunned her just enough to slow her down. Like, wait, is he talking to me? What's happening? David would have no way of knowing that that was her real name, but he wasn't talking to her. He was actually talking to his ugly-ass fiancée, Cindy Hendy. And like I said, I will call her ugly until my heart's content, because her heart is also ugly, and that's how we judge beauty around here. So let's keep moving. So David yells for Cindy, and this is when Cindy Hendy finally shows her face. She had come around from behind a curtain in the camper and shocked Cynthia with a massive red and white cattle prod. Cindy had shocked Cynthia in the neck to immobilize her, because once Cynthia was incapacitated and she wasn't going to be able to fight back to try to get away from them, David and Cindy handcuffed Cynthia to a cabinet inside the camper, and the initial shock from the cattle prod kind of knocked Cynthia out for a little bit. But when she finally did come to, the truck was still moving. They were on the road and they were driving. But Cynthia was hell-bent on getting away from these two, and she was going to do whatever she needed to get away from them. Cynthia played with the handcuffs on the cabinet, and she was actually able to get herself undone from the handcuffs. She was crouched down, and she had herself freed from the cuffs and the cabinet. She was just waiting on the truck to slow down or maybe even stop at a red light or stop sign so that she could jump out to get away from David and Cindy. But something happened, of course, that Cynthia couldn't have expected. There was no way that she would have expected this to happen. While she was crouched down waiting for the perfect moment to jump out of a moving truck, David hit the brakes on the truck pretty hard, which made Cynthia lose her balance and she fell into the cabinet. Of course, David and Cindy heard the commotion and they realized that she had gotten loose. So David pulls the truck over and he and Cindy both shackled and chained Cynthia back up. They took her back to their house and they put her in the toy box and did horrible, awful, unspeakable, and unimaginable things to her. Things that were discussed in graphic detail in the audio tape that I read for you last week. And of course, he played her this audio tape when she woke up in the toy box. Cynthia stayed in the toy box, chained up to a gynecology table, being raped, tortured, and held against her will for 3 days. But how did she escape? How did she manage to get away from David and Cindy? Well, I have to run in and check on my father-in-law, so we'll all find out when I get back. I'm back. And Cynthia's great escape would come on day 3, when David went to work and Cynthia finally saw her one chance, and damn it, she took it. On that morning when David went to work, he came into the little section beside the living room inside their mobile home, because this is where they had her at this point. And he basically told her that she had been such a good girl, that she had actually been so good he was going to take her chains and restraints off until he got home from work. He did leave a set of like leather cuffs that attached to each other, kind of like handcuffs, but leather. And that was basically the only thing that he had on her except for an electric shock collar that he had around her neck. She had also been so good that David thought she deserved a 5-gallon bucket and told her that that would be her restroom for the day and that she should try to get some rest because when he got home from work, they'd be going back out to the toy box again. And Cynthia would be left with David's ugly-ass fiancé, Cindy Hendy, for the whole day while David was at work. So Cindy and Cynthia are inside of this double-wide trailer and Cindy gets a phone call. And she's just kind of pacing the floor while she's on the phone. But Cynthia eventually walked out of the room that Cynthia was in. And Cynthia noticed that Cindy had left the keys to the handcuffs sitting on the end table. And the keys were just there, unattended, and basically screaming at Cynthia to unchain herself and to try to get out of this literal house of horrors. So Cynthia stretched her leg out as far as it would possibly go. And she somehow was able to use nothing more than just her leg to pull the table with the keys that was sitting on it closer to her, where she was able to get the keys. But something that always blows my mind when I read about her escape is the fact that even during this scary-ass moment, Cynthia had the wherewithal to think about what would happen if Cindy happened to walk back into the room and noticed that the table was moved. So instead of immediately unlocking her restraints, she moved the table back and then, with her legs still stretched out, pushing the table back in place, Cindy walks back into the room. Cindy sees that Cynthia is trying to move the table and immediately a struggle starts between both of them. Cindy actually busted a lamp over the top of Cynthia's head and I'm not sure how she was still able to fight back after that, but she was. And not only was she still able to fight back, she had also never let go of those keys. Those keys were her only chance at freedom and she knew it. So Cynthia was somehow able to get the phone even during the scuffle she was having with Cynthia and she was able to dial 911. But she wasn't actually able to speak to the 911 dispatcher and tell him what was going on because she was still fighting with Cindy. And out of nowhere, just like in a movie, Cynthia was able to find an ice pick. She says that she still to this day doesn't know where that ice pick came from, but it showed up and she used it. Cynthia stabbed Cindy Hendy in the forehead with the ice pick that she found, and that's when she was finally able to get the locks unlocked, and she made a beeline straight for the front door. Cynthia ran across a car almost as soon as she got outside of that mobile home, but the woman driving was probably scared shitless by a naked woman with nothing but a collar around her neck, and she was super bruised and beaten and bloody. Cynthia herself says that her wrist looked like hamburger meat from the chains and the pulley systems that David and Cindy had been using on her in the toy box. It was March 22nd, 1999, at about 3:22 p.m. in Sierra County, New Mexico, when a 911 call comes in. The call was kind of strange. No one was answering the questions that the dispatcher was asking, but the dispatcher could clearly hear what sounded like rustling and a struggle in the background. And then the call was disconnected. The dispatcher had an instinct that something wasn't right, and they called the number to David and Cindy's house back. And when a woman answered the phone, the dispatcher asked if everything was okay, and it was Cindy Hendy on the other line. Cindy was telling her that everything was fine and that they did not need to send an officer out, and then she just quickly hung up on the dispatcher. Thank God this 911 dispatcher listened to her gut instinct and called in for a welfare check at David Parker Ray's address, because she felt like something wasn't right with the hang-up call and then where she tried to call back, and Cindy was just out of breath, and she sounded stressed and even pissed when she was speaking to the 911 dispatcher. But at the same time that an officer is being sent out to Bass Road, where David and Cindy live, to do a welfare check, there were also multiple different 911 calls coming in about a woman running down the road naked with a metal electric collar around her neck. And as those different 911 calls are coming in, Cynthia had been beaten on every door to every house or mobile home that she passed. And she finally saw another home, and Cynthia didn't knock this time. She didn't ask to come in. She literally busted through the front door and told the woman that was standing at the kitchen sink washing dishes that she needed help. The woman was obviously confused and probably kind of frantic. The homeowner's husband came downstairs to see what all the commotion was. When he gets to the kitchen, where his wife is, he immediately knows something unspeakable has happened to this naked, beaten woman sitting at his kitchen table. So the husband goes and gets his wife's house coat and covers Cynthia up while his wife calls 911. Cynthia was panicked and so worried that David or Cindy were going to bust through these random people's house just to get her. So the man that lived in the house that Cynthia had ran into went and got his shotgun, and he made sure to let Cynthia know that there was absolutely no one coming inside this house to get her besides the police and an ambulance, and that they were on their way to help. So luckily, Cynthia picked a house where literal saints lived because they did everything right. Cynthia begged this couple to take the collar off of her and to please not let them come and get her. The man later said that it wasn't that he couldn't have gotten the collar off of her neck, but that he thought that the collar might be an important piece of evidence for the police to actually see when they got there. So, I mean, he didn't take it off, but I kind of get why. Cynthia was, of course, still pretty freaked out, especially since David had pretended to be a police officer when he initially kidnapped her. And that morning when he left for work, he was dressed in a National Park Rangers uniform, and that uniform looked an awful lot like a police uniform. So she had no way of knowing if he was actually a cop or not. She hid under this couple's kitchen table until the police arrived, and she was mortified. Like, she's just sitting under this kitchen table, crying, shaking, and scared to death. Like, what if David was one of the officers that were responding to the 911 call that the couple made? She had every right to be freaked out. But David wasn't a police officer, thank God, and he wasn't coming to get her, and the police did show up. The police showed up, and they tried really hard to explain that, you know, they would keep her safe and that she was safe with them. The police that showed up took Cynthia's statement. They took her to the hospital so she could be treated for her injuries. Cynthia didn't know where she had even been, but she had heard her kidnappers talking to each other, and she did know that they went by David and Cindy, or Dave and Cindy, you know, either or. And that made it pretty easy to figure out who it was, considering the first 911 call that Cynthia had made had came from the address of David Parker Ray and his girlfriend, Cindy Hendy. Also, what kind of name is Cindy Hendy? I just want to throw that out there. So, Cynthia and David were actually found driving around only about a block away from their house, and they were immediately taken into custody. Cynthia gave her statement to the police, and when the officers that had taken her statement went back into where David and Cindy were being held in separate rooms, they had the audacity to say that, yes, they had actually kidnapped Cynthia. but that they had done it for her own good, that the only reason they had kidnapped her was to help her through an unwilling and unwanted detox of treatment for heroin addiction. Like, I'm sorry, what kind of shit is that? If she did not ask for your help kicking her addiction, then that is not up to you to decide. So now they're making it out to be like, oh, we were just trying to be good Samaritans, and she's strung out on heroin, so she needed help. No, there are rehab facilities for that, and she was aware of that. So, luckily, no one was buying what David and Cindy were selling. They were like, eh, that sounds like a crock of crap. We're going to keep investigating. And they were able to get a search warrant for the double wide where David and Cindy lived on March 23rd, 1999. During this search warrant, they found tons and tons and tons of things that did not belong to David or Cindy. And I'm pretty sure that when I was looking through the pictures of just items that they found that didn't belong to them, there were over 400 items. Necklaces, underwear, clothes, purses, bathing suits. I mean, you name it, they had it and none of it belonged to them. They were also able to find a crazy, stupid amount of dildos when they did this search warrant, homemade torture devices, and pieces of jewelry and underwear, like I said, that were found that did not belong to Cindy or David. But they were able to find the clothes that Cynthia had been wearing on the night that they kidnapped her just 3 days prior. And just to list a few of the things that were found during the search of David and Cindy's house were things labeled like he had actually gotten a pretty much a label maker. And if it wasn't a label maker, he had handwritten it on these objects. Some of these things were labeled leg spreader. There was another one that was labeled knee spreader, along with a 15-inch dildo that was motorized that was attached to a motor with a switch to be able to change the functions. And there were three functions listed, and the three functions were listed as buzzer, light, and probe. Like, oh my God, what? They also found multiple types of whips, ropes, chains, clamps, massive dildos, and a homemade gynecology table that was made out of an old weight bench with a huge mirror mounted on the ceilings so that his victims could watch what he and Cindy were doing to them while they were strapped to this homemade gynecology table. They also found this like hand type of thing that looked like the glove that Freddy Krueger would use in movies. Like it had the razor fingers, everything. They also found literal surgical instruments, the fake police badge that David had used to kidnap Cynthia and probably multiple other women. They found journals that David had kept for years and years and years, dating back to his teenage years. And in these journals were different dates, times, and locations, and each woman's name. But there were also little tally marks of how many times David had tortured each woman. He was legitimately keeping score for his own sick pleasure. There were also multiple different homemade objects that David himself had made and even sold on the internet to other people that were just as sick as him. One of which was some sort of contraption that was solely made for the purpose of forcing a woman to be bent over and on all fours, and I would be willing to bet my very last dollar that this was the same contraption that would be used for the dog incident. And if you don't know what the dog incident is, we're not going to get into that again. That was pretty graphic, and my nerves cannot handle that today. So, put two and two together. We're all grown-ups. Let's figure it out. So, that's all I'm going to say about that. David and Cindy's house was disgusting. It was littered with drawings of women being tortured, and even pictures and diagrams of sex organs and books on anatomy. Oh, you know, to be able to know exactly where and how to torture someone to be able to inflict the most maximum amount of pain. These two are literally the sickest kinds of people out there. They're right up there in the same wheelhouse with pedophiles. When officers were searching the property and they got to the toy box, there were locks that, like, they were so, the toy box was so locked up, they couldn't even pry it open. They had to actually get a locksmith out there to be able to even enter the toy box. And most, if all of the things that I've already listed were inside the toy box. There were also hand-painted signs that said stuff like Satan's Den and other weird things like that. During their search of David and Cindy's home is where they found a lot of David's journal entries and tapes. They found lots and lots of videotapes of multiple women being tortured and multiple audio tapes of David recording himself and perfecting his quote-unquote introduction tapes that we all somehow managed to sit through last week. So the FBI and the Behavioral Science Unit were called in to help on this case and to process the evidence that they were finding, because there were mounds and mounds and mounds of evidence that needed to be processed. Cindy cracked like a freaking egg almost immediately after questioning. As soon as they started throwing out hard questions, she opened a whole ass can of worms. David was more than 20 years older than his fiancée, Cindy Hendy, and Cindy told police that David had told her from the get-go what he was into and what he liked to do. So she knew from day one that he was into kidnapping, torturing, and raping women, and I guess she just thought it was okay. I don't know. Apparently, she was just so infatuated with David and so obsessed with him that it didn't really matter what his quote-unquote kinks were. She was there for it. I'll still never understand how two people this sick find each other, but against all odds, these two did. Cindy said that David had told her about his love of kidnapping and torturing women in the very early stages of their relationship, and that at first she was kind of shocked and put off by the thought, but that she was so obsessed with him that she just accepted it and even joined in on it. So I say that to say this. Go Google David Parker Ray, or check the Mama Murdered a Podcast social media accounts, because I did post pictures of David, and he is not anything special to look at. He's actually gross to look at. So I don't even know how she could be so obsessed with him, and we can all just collectively agree that she had the most daddy issues. David Parker Ray and Cindy Hendy were both arrested after this, and they were both charged with 2 counts of conspiracy, 1 count of kidnapping, 1 count of assault, 1 count of criminal sexual penetration, and they were both transferred to the Sierra County Detention Center, and they both just stopped talking to the police and cooperating with law enforcement. But the oddest thing is that David's employer was actually so convinced that he was innocent throughout this entire investigation and all the way up into the trial that they had David on paid leave. Like, they honestly thought the police had the wrong guy. Everybody that David worked with said that he was just the sweetest thing ever, and that he was always the type that would just go out of his way to help somebody. And his bosses paid him for the entire time that he was in jail and all the way up until the trial started. So I'm guessing that after they saw the evidence that they were convinced that maybe he was not so innocent. Cindy told police about David's supposed first murder when he was a teen and about other women that he'd killed over the years. Cindy also claimed that David told her that he had killed more than 30 people and that only about 18 of those would be in Sierra County, where Elephant Butte was located. And although none of the bodies were ever found, it is believed that David is also a drifter, so it would be almost impossible to even attempt to pinpoint all of the locations where he had been living at any given time. So it would even be hard to know where to start looking for missing women and scattered bodies until he finally settled down with Cindy Hendy in Elephant Butte. Because according to what Cindy said that David told her during their relationship, that she said that David said that bodies could be found throughout basically the entire country, including New Mexico, Texas, and even Alaska. So that would also make it pretty hard to track down. And I feel like this is a good time to mention that this particular part of New Mexico in the Elephant Butte Lake is known for massive catfish. These catfish are huge, like upwards of sometimes even, and even exceeding 80 pounds. So this would be another way to get rid of a body. Catfish are bottom feeders, and they will literally eat anything. According to Cindy, David said that the best way to get rid of a body wasn't just to weigh it down and dump it in a big body of water with huge catfish. He said he learned his lesson throughout his experiences, and that after a certain amount of time, that the air would still eventually make the body float to the top of the water. So he had basically perfected his way of disposing bodies by removing the internal organs so that they would never float to the surface. And police have searched Elephant Butte Lake many, many, many times, and they have still yet to find one single body, which is just so crazy to me. So now, like I mentioned, the police and FBI found hundreds and hundreds of videotapes and different women being tortured by David. Some of those videos even show good old Cindy Hendy doing things just as bad as what David was seen doing. And she also seemed to enjoy it just as much as David did. But none of these videos showed enough of the women's, like, facial features to identify who any of them are. That was until they got to one tape. In this one tape, there was a woman with a tattoo. It was blurry and it was hard to make out, so the FBI got to work with enhancements and trying to clear up the image of just the part of the tape where the tattoo was shown on the woman. And finally, when the tattoo in the video was cleared up enough to be able to make out what it was, they released it to the public. But they only released the picture of the tattoo. Apparently, this was a pretty distinct kind of tattoo, not like a heart or a butterfly or something that hundreds and thousands of girls have. And when they released it to the public asking for anybody who recognized this tattoo to come forward, they found another survivor of David Parker Ray and his toy box, Kelly Garrett. And I've seen Kelly's last name listed as Garrett, and I've also seen her last name listed as Van Cleve. And I'm thinking that one is her maiden name and one is her married name, but I'm not 100% sure. We're just going to go with Kelly Garrett. But either way, Kelly wasn't even living in New Mexico when she found out that she had been one of David's victims. Because yes, you just heard me right. She found out she was one of David Parker Ray's victims. Kelly had no memory of what had happened to her during her time in the toy box with David and Cindy. Kelly was living in Colorado at the time that she saw her own tattoo in relation to the case, and she came forward. Kelly had been a newly married woman when she was kidnapped in 1996. Kelly and her husband had been living with her husband's parents at the time, and she and her husband had been having an argument when Kelly left to go to a bar and to blow off some steam. Well, at the bar, Kelly ran into none other than David Parker Ray's daughter, Jessie Ray, while she was there. After they talked a little bit, Kelly had only had one drink at the bar, and she felt like she had had 30, and she didn't want to drive herself home. So instead, her supposed friend, Jessie Ray, suggested that the two go back to Jessie's dad's house and just sleep it off. Kelly was grateful for the ride, and the two headed to David's house. But Kelly wouldn't return home to her husband or her in-laws for days. And when she did return home, it was actually David who dropped her off at home. David legitimately drove Kelly back to her own house in his National Park Rangers uniform and told her husband and her in-laws that he had picked her up on the side of the road and that she had been walking home, so he gave her a lift home instead of letting her walk. And here's a quote from Kelly about what David told her about the way that he found her. Kelly said, quote, "David told me that he found me wandering the beach and that I was incoherent." So he basically just told her that he found her walking around the beach and he decided to stop and give her a ride home. So Kelly's husband and in-laws just kind of thanked David and he went on his way. Now, Kelly couldn't remember where she had been for days and she couldn't remember what had even happened to her. Kelly's husband and her in-laws were convinced that Kelly had been out sleeping with other men and had gone into like a drug bender for the entire time that she had been missing, and mostly because she couldn't give them an actual reason for why she hadn't come home. I don't know that anybody would immediately jump to, "I've been drugged and kidnapped," when your spouse comes home and doesn't remember what's even happened to them for the last few days. I don't know what you would jump to, but I just feel like it's not kidnapping and drugged. Kelly had been dropped off at her in-laws completely barefoot and wearing the exact same clothes that she had been wearing 3 days before when she left her house that night after the fight with her husband. And what's even more telling than that is that Kelly was also covered in bruises, cuts, and scrapes, and she was sore from her head to her toes. Kelly and her husband would go into divorce after Kelly's 3 days of missing time with no good or logical explanation. And it wasn't until Kelly saw her own tattoo in relation to this case and after she reached out to the police working the case that she learned the truth. Kelly had been drugged by David's daughter, Jessie Ray, and taken to David to be used in his toy box. And Kelly only agreed to go to David's house because she had met David before. I mean, to her, this was her friend's dad and she could trust him, right? No, don't trust anybody. Kelly thought she was going somewhere where she would be safe, and just because she was going to her friend's parents' house, you know, she felt like she didn't really have to worry about it. And sadly, she could not have been more wrong. Kelly learned that not only had she been raped, tortured, and kidnapped, that she had also been filmed in David's toy box, and she'd also had unimaginable things done to her. That's when suddenly everything clicked. Kelly had eventually remarried and moved to Colorado after her unexplained missing 3 days of time in Elephant Butte, and strangely, ever since those missing 3 days of time, Kelly had been suffering from terrible, extremely realistic nightmares. She struggled with having sex with her new husband, and she couldn't really explain why. Well, up until this point, anyways. But David had given Kelly his magical medical concoction of forget-me meds and truth serum, and he had given her, and probably most of the other women that he let go, a mixture of sodium pentothal and phenobarbital. And she had actually forgotten damn near everything that had happened to her. But she would have super realistic dreams about being raped and tied up and tortured, but she could never figure out why she always had those same dreams, and now it all made perfect sense. She had just kind of always thought that those were nightmares or night terrors, and she didn't know that she had actually lived those horrible things, and that's where her dream started. Kelly had never reported these 3 days of missing time because, honestly, she couldn't remember what happened. It would be hard to report something that you don't remember and something that you think is just a bad dream. And thank God Jesse Ray was also arrested after everything that Kelly did finally start to remember. Once she was able to remember things, they were kind of able to line it up and corroborate it with what was on the tapes. And the whole reason that they found Kelly was because there was also another woman that Cindy Hendy told police about. This was a woman by the name of Angela. Cindy didn't give any last names. She just said that the abduction of Angela took place about a month before Cynthia was abducted. And I know I'm throwing a lot of names at y'all, but remember that Cynthia's the one that got away, found the older, nicer couple, and called police. So once the police located this woman, who was actually named Angelica Montano, they kind of made the assumption that there were other victims out there, and that's when the police released the picture of Kelly's tattoo, and that's probably the only way that they even learned about Kelly and her abduction at all. Because up until Cindy Hendy told police about Angela, they had no idea about Kelly, and it just kind of all started to roll itself into place after that. So police would later find out that the woman that Cindy Hendy just kept calling Angela was actually Angelica Montano, and that she had lived in Truth or Consequences, which is literally the town right next to Elephant Butte where David and Cindy Hendy lived in 1999. And she was also known to frequent the same bars and restaurants and shit where Cindy Hendy would go to hang out. So far, all of this tracks with Cindy Hendy saying that they had taken a woman named Angela in February of 1999. Because it was on Wednesday, February 17th, 1999, that Cindy Hendy was at the bar where Angelica was also at, drinking and hanging out. Cindy Hendy and Angelica were acquaintances, but I wouldn't say they were friends per se, mainly because friends don't kidnap friends, but they did know each other and they hang out at the same bars. So while Cindy and Angelica are hanging out at the bar, drinking, living their best lives, Cindy Hendy asks Angelica if she wants to head back to their place for a while, and naturally, Angelica agrees. Because she's there under the impression that she's just going to a friend's house to hang out, and that doesn't seem dangerous to most of us, but it was. When Cindy and Angelica got back to David and Cindy's house, she was overtaken by both David and Cindy, and she was tied up and strapped to the same gynecology table that most likely all of the other victims had been strapped to. And Angelica was held for 4 days in David and Cindy's toy box, and somehow Angelica was able to convince Cindy, more than David, that they should just let her go. Because she had a young kid at home, and Angelica said that Cindy did help David the entire time. David and Cindy Hendy did let Angelica go, like I said. They left her sitting on the side of the highway with no way home. Angelica was trying to hitchhike her way back to her mom's house when an off-duty police officer picked her up. So you would think that this would be the end of David Parker Ray and Cindy Hendy and their godforsaken toy box, but it wasn't. Want to guess why it wasn't? Because Angelica told this off-duty officer everything. About the torture, about the rape, about the kidnapping, about the toy box, about everything. And this off-duty officer literally did not believe her. He thought that this story was so outlandish and so out there that he had never even so much as followed up on David or Cindy. He didn't even make a report about what Angelica had told him. He never went to Cindy and David's house to question them about the allegations, and excuse my language, but what in the actual fuck, how does that happen? How does someone tell an actual police officer all of that and the officer doesn't even report it? He doesn't say anything to anyone else about it and he doesn't follow up on it. He doesn't do anything, literally anything. This is making me crazy. Now, Cindy Hendy claims that she was never there when women were murdered, but she had no problems being there for the kidnapping, rapes, and torture, so I don't think she was trying to prove being like, oh, I was never there when he killed anyone, though. Like, that doesn't matter. You know what was going on. You're just as much at fault. Now, police questioned both of David's kids during the investigation. David Jr. said that even though he had never been close to his dad, that he couldn't just turn on him. And Jesse and David had always been super close, and she'd even helped abduct some of these women. But in the audio tapes, David said something along the lines of he and his lady friend had some kinky hangups. He also said that the tape had been pre-recorded in 1993. From my memory, it was 1993, I think. But David didn't know Cindy Hendy in 1993. David and Cindy had only been dating for, oh God, I can't remember, it's 3 years or 8 months, but it's one of the two, before they got arrested. So either way, not long enough to be back in 1993. So was Jessie Rae helping her dad with more than just kidnapping women? Like, was she actively participating in Toy Box activities before he got with Cindy? Like, were Jessie and her dad, like, sleeping together and torturing women together? Because that's definitely what it sounds like to me. Cindy Hendy and her lawyers agreed to basically turn against David and give them information to help prosecute him in return for them giving her a lesser charge. Cindy gave them all kind of information, and she also agreed to testify against David when he went to jail. But in the short time that Cindy and David had been together, Cindy told police that they had abducted somewhere between 14 or 15 women, and that the majority of them were murdered and thrown into Elephant Butte Lake. Now, Elephant Butte Lake and the state park and lots of other places around have been searched over and over and over, and like I said, they just never find anything. But let's also keep in mind that David and Cindy had tons of animals in their lot on Elephant Butte, so there's a good possibility that they may have just fed a lot of the bodies to their animals, because most animals will eat basically anything. And there would be absolutely no way to prove that or even know that if that's what happened or not. And if you weren't able to listen or finish last week's episode where I did the rereading of the audio tapes that David would play for his victims when they would wake up in his toy box, then you may have missed the part about the questionnaire that David made every one of his captives fill out. It was basically a very long and detailed questionnaire about the medical history, any childbirths that they may have had, any medical conditions he should know about, their period dates, and so on and so forth. But that wasn't all he kept. He also kept the journals with each date of the kidnappings, the amount of torture inflicted on each victims, and like more super creepy things of that nature. And as if the journal entries and the questionnaires weren't enough, David would also throw what he referred to as parties, where he would invite people over to his mobile home to watch him rape his kidnapped victims. He would also do what he called, quote, putting on a show, which was when he would strap these women down to the homemade table and leave them forcibly bent over. He would then spray breeder's musk on them and let his German Shepherd rape these women while he, his friends, and Cindy Hendy watched. Tell me that she had nothing to do with this and that she was a victim also, and I'll tell you that you're wrong. One of the only people that police knew for sure was there for these little shows that were being put on was a man named Roy Yancey. Roy was younger than David, and when police finally talked to Roy Yancey about what Cindy and David had been saying, he basically just told him that, yeah, all those things had happened, and that he had been there for a lot of those quote-unquote shows, and he didn't even try to hide it. Roy did tell police that David kind of forced Roy's hand into killing a woman named Marie one time. How do you force someone into killing someone else? I'm not sure, but that's what he says happened. Roy says that he and Marie had been dating in 1997 and that Roy had taken his girlfriend Marie to a party at David's house where, of course, David drugged Roy's girlfriend. So after David drugged Roy's girlfriend, David made Roy help him carry this woman into the toy box. And Roy claims that after he and David got Marie into David's toy box, David handed him a rope and held a gun to his head and told him that he knew what he had to do. Roy says that in that moment, he knew that it was either going to be his girlfriend or himself. And Roy chose himself. After Roy murdered his literal girlfriend, David and Roy then drove her body out to the desert and left her body there. Now, let's remember that Roy is just spilling all this to the police. So Roy's even agreed to take police to the place where him and David had dumped Marie's body. But when police went to search, they never found the body. And they kind of went back to Roy like, hey, buddy. There wasn't a woman's dead body there, so, you know, where did you say you dumped her? That's when Roy told police that he felt like David had gone back to that burial site alone afterwards and moved her body so that, you know, if Roy ever did say anything, David could just kind of be like, well, that's not where her body is, so it must have been him and not me. David was very organized and meticulous, even though he looks like a slick-haired, slow-talking country bumpkin. He's very organized and very meticulous. Roy said that there were rumors about the toy box at David's house, but that he had never seen it until that night when David drugged Roy's girlfriend and forced him to drag her into the toy box and kill her. So it seems like people around town just knew about this toy box and nobody seemed to care enough to check. Like, how did this many people know about the toy box, yet David was still able to get away with this for so long? So, David's not speaking to the police. Cindy's spilling her guts. Jesse Ray is saying whatever they're asking. Roy Yancey is just flat out saying, yes, everything that you just said happened. And David's son is like, meh, I'm not going to turn on my dad. So even with all these confessions and eyewitness accounts and stuff, there still weren't any bodies found, and no bodies have ever been found to this day. This was going to make it that much harder to actually try David Parker Ray in a criminal conviction case. And they wouldn't be able to charge him for any murders or manslaughters or anything else that falls into the murder realm. Out of all the women that David Parker Ray and Cindy Hendy claimed to have killed, they were never charged with murder. The police even checked the Elephant Butte Lake, all the surrounding areas, but the lake was 23 miles long. They'll never be able to search it all at once to do a super thorough search. They had searched anywhere and everywhere that they thought bodies might be, with still no luck. But David was going to stand trial for 3 separate trials. One for Kelly, one for Angelica, and one for Cynthia. But 5 months before Kelly's trial, Roy Yancey just all of a sudden changed his mind about testifying against David, because Roy had gotten a letter in jail that said something along the lines of, rats die in jail, which we're pretty sure came from David, even though he was behind bars. So instead of testifying against David, Roy just pled guilty to second-degree murder, got 30 years in prison, and washed his hands of it. And David wasn't going to stop there, because David caught wind that Cindy Hendy was also planning to testify against him in court. So instead of writing her a threatening, little message, he did the complete opposite, and he started sending her love letters in prison, and he even went so far as to get her name tattooed on his body. Cindy Hendy. You gotta love it. So now, instead of testifying against David, Cindy just kind of starts recounting her confessions, because for whatever reason, and only God knows why, but Cindy Hendy was literally obsessed with David, and the love letters worked. When Cindy did go to trial, she was sentenced to 36 years in prison for the abduction and torture of Angela and Cynthia. But let me go ahead and piss you off now, because old Cindy Hendy has actually been released from prison already, and she was released on July 15th, 2019. So she's literally out here walking these streets right now as I speak. There wasn't a whole lot that they could actually prove that David Parker Ray had done. And when Kelly testified against David during the trial against him, she said that she didn't want David to get off easy, on the death penalty. She wanted him to suffer for as long as he was going to be alive. And Kelly was the one that was in the videotape that David had recorded. So his defense just tried to say that this was consensual BDSM and consensual sex. Even though Kelly wasn't awake during most of the tape, and David's defense team would say that all of the girls that he'd ever had inside the toy box had agreed to do it for payment or drugs or both. And of course, because our justice system is so broken and so trashy, this jury ended up being deadlocked. 2 of the jurors could not decide if what they were shown in the videotapes was consensual or not. And for Cynthia's trial in 2001, she testified in her own trial, which I'll never understand how some women have the bravery to do that. But Cynthia had been awake and alert during most of her time in the toy box, and most of the time that she was with David and Cindy. And she was going to make sure that the jury knew that she had not agreed to this in any way, shape, or form. And right before the jury was sent off to deliberate in Cynthia's trial, David Zoyer stood up to let the judge know that all of a sudden David wanted to take a plea deal. And the only reason that David finally agreed to a plea deal was because his little daughter Jessie Ray was about to start trial soon. And David agreed to take a plea deal to do all of the remaining charges if and only if Jessie Ray was released with whatever little bit of time she had already served. David was then sentenced to 224 years in prison with his plea deal in hand. And Jessie Ray was actually released and pled no contest to her kidnapping charges and was only sentenced to 2.5 years in prison plus 5 years of probation. My next little tidbit is finally the end of this gross-ass case. And in May of 2002, after David found God in prison, because who doesn't find God in prison? He contacted authorities and told them that he would finally talk. And of course, police were like, hell yeah. And naturally, just because this is how things work, David had a massive heart attack and died right before his meeting was scheduled. And he had actually only served 8 months out of his 224-year sentence before he died. David had been in prison for maybe 2.5 years while he was waiting on the trials to start and finish and stuff. But after he was actually sentenced, he legit only served 8 months and he died. So all the shit that this man did to all of the women that he hurt, tortured, raped, and murdered, he served a whopping 8 months before he had a heart attack and died. He basically got off scot-free for all of the shit that he did, and it just pisses me off so bad. And Cindy Hendy's out walking the streets, Jesse Ray's out walking the streets, David's dead, and hopefully rotten in hell where he belongs. But tell me how David's friend Roy Yancey did more time than David did. Make it make sense. Oh, from what I could find, Cindy Hendy is living in Hamilton, Montana now, and according to kpax.com, there are three different levels to three different types of offenders, and level one is listed at a low risk of repeating the offense that they were charged with. Level two is listed at a moderate risk of reoffending the same offense they were charged with. And level three offenders are listed as a higher risk of reoffending the same charges they were already charged with. Level three offenders have restrictions on where they can live, who they can be around, interact with, and they have to follow certain laws that go along with those restrictions. But levels one and two don't have restrictions on anything. And Cindy Hendy's out here living her best life at a level one offender with no restrictions on where she can live, who she can be around. She can basically do what she wants. So my guess would be that she probably already found her like a new nasty boo thing, and they're probably doing the same sick shit somewhere else. And I believe that is finally that on that. That is the case of David Parker Ray and Cindy Hendy, and these two are a different breed of human. Again, I'm super, super sorry for how late this episode is, and I'm not going to make any promises for next week because I'm just not sure what's going on with my father-in-law yet. He doesn't seem to be getting better, but we're going to play it by ear. I'm recording this live from my car, so I'll see you next time. Hopefully not the same place, but I will see you then, though.
That's how my mama
murdered a podcast.